Good morning, everyone. Good to have you with us. If you have your Bible, you might be turning to the book of 1 Timothy. We've been looking at this great letter that Paul wrote to Timothy and his advice that he was giving him on how to handle the situation there at Ephesus and some of the things that he was supposed to teach. Last week, we looked at some of the rest of the passages in chapter 2, but there were several questions people had. Whatever I said last week obviously was a little muddled, so we're going to spend just a couple of minutes this morning and I hope straighten something out so that we can move on pretty quickly. But this is an important passage that we need to deal with because there's been a lot of misconception and a lot of misinterpretation over the years and misapplication as well. So it behooves us to spend just a little bit of time to kind of work on it and get it straightened out. Before we start this morning, I'm going to ask Drew, if you would, to lead us in a word of prayer, please.
Our most gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for today. Thank you for the rains that have come and are coming. And we thank you for bringing us together. Give us all the many blessings that you give us. Please bless us here today as we worship you, as we remember your Son. Let us do so with a clear mind and thinking only of you, Jesus, and the great things that you've done for us. Your Lord be with our teachers now as they go through the study that they have prepared for each of the classes. May they present it in the way that they have prepared it, and may it be
this whole section that really starts in the first chapter of Timothy and continues down through the end of the third chapter really is dealing with people and their behavior in the church. We've looked at that and said, look at a theme passage. If we look at the third chapter in verse 15, I want to keep this one in mind, verses 14 and 15. He says, I am writing these things to you, hoping to come to you before long. But in case I am delayed, I write so that you will know how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God. Now, we'll stop there. We'll talk about the rest of the verse later. But he's making a comment on what he has previously written, and saying, I wrote this so that everyone would know how to behave. And in fact, he's covering a lot of territory. We tend to concentrate on this one passage here about women, but he started with the men where he said, I want men in every place to lift up holy hands and pray. And we talked about the fact that he wants them to pray without wrath and dissension. So he is covering a problem that was there at Ephesus, which was there was a lot of dissension, even among the men. And it was leading to them with having bad prayers in their lives and in their service. But that's another piece that I want to emphasize, is that we have to be careful how we interpret household of God here. Because as we go down and look at these things, he's not just talking about the assembly, when people come together for the specific purpose of worshiping and serving God. And I think you can see that when he starts talking about things like the women wearing modest apparel. Do you think that was only when they were in services? No, that was for their whole lives, right? That was a characteristic that they were supposed to have. When he says, I want men everywhere to lift up holy hands and pray without dissension, was that just in the services? No, that was a general thing for them to apply. So let's keep that in mind. When he's talking about elders and deacons and the qualifications that they have, and we're going to get to that hopefully a little later in this class, those are not just things that they have to have, while they're in the assembly. Those are characteristics of their lives, as we'll see. So let's keep that in mind as we go through these verses here. So I want to start by reading in chapter 2, beginning in verse 9. I'm going to read down through 15. We're not going to talk as much about the early part because we've done that several times. But it's all in one piece, and we got to get the whole context here, or the subcontext. Bigger context is how to behave in the household of God. Then he says, likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly garments, but rather by means of good works, as is proper for women, making a claim to godliness. A woman must quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness. But I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. For it was Adam who was first created, and then Eve. And it was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. But women will be preserved through the bearing of children, if they continue in faith and love and sanctity with self-constraint. Now, the reason I put that last verse up on the screen is you can see that there are several different renditions of that. New American Standard says women will be preserved. ESV says she will be saved through childbearing. Young's Literal also says she there. We talked a little bit about last week about this is a little bit of a difficult verse in a lot of ways. The grammar is difficult in the Greek. The translations, as it moves between singular and plural and this comparison with Adam and Eve, get to be a little difficult. And I think I spent too much time on that. So let's go back and talk about how it all fits together and how it kind of makes sense. First of all, as we start looking at verse 11, a woman must quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness. We're talking about a place here. What was our context again? The household of God. And he says, I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. Now, we also emphasized last week that remain quiet is the same word that's used as quietness. It doesn't mean absolute silence. It's not the same context as what he had over in 1 Corinthians when he was talking about the abuse of spiritual gifts that they had and the ruckus that was going on during their assembly, where he said very clearly there, be quiet, as in don't talk. But in this context, he's talking about that spirit, the same one that Peter talks about when he says that quiet spirit that is so precious in the sight of God. That's the same context that he's got here with these women. Now, when you look at that, the world has a problem with this. And I think part of it is sometimes trying to fit it in. And I don't know the best way to explain all of it, so let's go down and start with some brackets. Sometimes when you look at something, it's best to go, what is it really not? Is he saying here that women should never teach? How do we know that? What's that? Okay, in Acts, Aquila and Priscilla took Apollos aside. It doesn't just say Aquila there, it says both of them, right? Even in Timothy, aren't there passages where he says he wants the older women to teach the younger women? Okay? And when he talks about Timothy and he says, I know from your childhood that you were taught the scriptures. Who taught him? His mother and his grandmother, right? Okay, so it cannot be an absolute prohibition against teaching. But is there a teaching context in the household of God? That is where he's saying they're not to teach over a man or exercise authority over a man. That's a fairly clear context and containment. So how does that deal with what people have today as a problem with women in the workplace, for example? You have to be careful there, but the point is, when it's talking about teaching or exercising authority, and the context is the household of God, the whole point has been they've got a lot of false teachers, a lot of false things going on, there's misinformation going on, and he's saying the women are part of that problem. He doesn't want them teaching over those who are the teachers and the leaders and the authorities there, and he's going to cover that when he talks to the elders and the deacons. And so that's the context, and we have to be careful with that. It says, exercise authority over. I want to talk about another thing that comes up quite often. When someone is baptized and they become a Christian, they are a child of God. And that happens at different ages. What happens when a 13-year-old boy, I use that word in particular, is baptized and becomes a member of God's family? Does that automatically make him a man? Does that give him any other position of authority? So there are people who are uncomfortable with a woman teaching a class where there are boys in that age group who are Christians. But this verse doesn't really apply to that. Those boys don't have any authority. They're not teaching with authority. Now, where is that age? Well, okay, as you start getting up higher, I think there's a break point where people start understanding where people are responsible as men, not just as Christians. And so, yeah, we got to be careful with how we apply that, because this passage does apply in the household of God. And that's where we need to be careful with it, because as we go on here, he then talks about this example. And you might say, well, why should a woman be limited in that? And the reason that he gives starts in verse 13. He says, for, meaning for this reason, because, here's my explanation for this, Adam was created first. Yeah, sure. Household of God. Easy. Let's go back here and where he says, let's go to verse 15. He says, how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God, which is, what does it say? The church of the living God. The household of God is the church of the living God. It is when you become a Christian and part of the kingdom of God, you are part of the household of God.
Yes, yeah, so I'm thinking about at-home Bible studies, right?
Sure.
So within our Bible studies, we have at-home Bible studies.
Sure.
And you made a reference to a quote from Priscilla and how they, you know, they taught at their house, right? But if you're saying that a female should exercise authority over a man in the household of God, that applies to, you see the confusion.
Teach over or exercise authority over. Right. Okay. So at that point, what you're looking at is who's in authority, who's the one whose teaching is considered to be the one expounding the truth that is, okay, what's a good way to say that? Let's go with what he's got here in terms of like elders. And it's a very good question, excellent question. When you look at who is responsible in teaching in the church and who is in positions of authority in the church, okay? He's giving a couple of different positions there. Even in marriage, does this apply? It's not in this verse, but that submissiveness also occurs when he says in Ephesians that wives are be in subjection to their husbands, right? I mean, that verse is still there as well. And would studying together and expressing an opinion be out of subjection? Well, I think that depends on attitude and how it's done a lot of times. So it's not a prohibition against speaking in a teaching situation, in a class situation. We got that prohibition against the assembly in 1 Corinthians. But it is an injunction when he starts looking at someone who would exercise that position of authority to be able to stand up and say, I'm the one that's presenting exactly what's true. There are those of us who have to do that. I tell you, when you're teaching a class like I'm doing now, okay, or when Mark gets up and delivers a sermon, or when any of us get up in a position where we're teaching, there is an incredible responsibility there that none of us really take lightly, I guarantee. Because you think through these things and you're trying to come up and make sure that what you're teaching and what you're saying is in line with the scripture. And there is an expectation on the audience's part that they should be able to trust what we're saying. Is that not true? Now, does that relieve you as the audience of responsibility for thinking for yourselves and checking out what I'm saying? It does not. But the reason I'm here is because there's some expectation that I've studied it enough that I might be able to help you understand it. Now, would a woman standing here in this context not be viewed in that same light? And I think that applies in this passage. Now, when I ask for questions and people express things, are they exercising authority over me or teaching over me? That's part of it. Absolutely. But I also will say it depends on how that answer is done, does it not? Because I have been in places where women have been extremely assertive from their seats to the point of arguing in a manner that borders on not being right. And those are the kinds of things I think he's talking about. Let them learn in all submissiveness. If they have any questions, let them take it to their home. Let's not argue about it here in this context, in this class context. Is there a really clear line that I can always tell you exactly where things go? No. Okay, I'm not trying to draw an absolute black or white line there. What I am trying to say is there's some principles involved that we have to be careful with. And because it can be difficult doesn't mean that we just go, you know what, that's too tough, I'm just going to ignore it. And that's the tendency a lot of people have in today's world, is I don't like what this might say, and therefore I'm going to say Paul was wrong, and let's not worry about it. I've read commentaries that say that. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so let's continue on that and talk about roles here. Right? Okay. Good example. In case you didn't hear, she was saying that there were occasions even on this last Wednesday, set of Wednesday nights when we were meeting in our homes, when I was out of town, and we had Benjamin lead the class. And that, even though it's our home and Debbie was there, that kept her out of being in that position of authority in leading the class. It's a lot of role relationships, and I think that's what he really means when he gets down to this reasoning where he says Adam was created first. Did that make Adam better? Is there any indication that it made him better in any way? No, and if it was first is better, it was the way it meant, then who's better than Adam? All the birds and the fish and the plants and everything else, right? They got created before he did. So it's not the order of creation there in the sense of better. It's the order of the sense of what? Role, responsibility. Ah, the sin comes next. He says Adam was created first. That's reason number one. I think he splits it into two parts. Reason number two, who was deceived? Eve was deceived. And a lot of people want to look at that one and go, you see, I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but women's minds are more susceptible to being misled. Okay? And for many years, that's what was taught about this passage. Is that what he's saying? No. He's saying there was a consequence to that action. Part of the consequence of that, and that's what he's bringing over in roles, is that Adam was given a head role. In marriage, there's a head of the household. Let me make a little side analogy here. In today's world, authority is something that many people have difficulty with. Okay? And so even sometimes on a work project, they will assign a team, okay? And you will have four or five people that are part of the team. And they're supposed to work together. There's supposed to be this sort of, we call it the kumbaya feeling, you know, that if we all just get along and we'll all make these group decisions. And how well will you always make group decisions in a group larger than one? Not very well. Okay? And what I have found over my 40 years of experience is there really has to be somebody in charge. Because at some point there will be a disagreement and you will have to decide on something in order to keep from being, you know, just stalemated. And it's that person that's in charge that's responsible. Now, if they're good, they will try to get buy-in. They will try to persuade. They will try to get people convinced. There's all kinds of ways that you can try to bring this along together because as a leader, you are responsible for the team. But when push comes to shove, there's somebody that's got to say, I'm sorry, not everybody agrees. This is the way we're going. And if you're part of the team, your responsibility is to go, you know what, we argued, we talked, we decided, all right, I'm on board, let's go. I may not totally agree, but if I'm part of this, I got two choices. I go with the team or get off of it, one or the other. And I think so. And I think what that's the way he's reasoning through this. And so when he looks at it, he says, Adam's first. Together, this reasons, Eve deceived. They are dealing with the roles and headship relationship. In 1 Corinthians 11, when you go over there, that whole passage is all about headship. It's about the line of authority. People understand that in the military. Paul even referred to it, right? We had the centurion that came to Christ and said he wanted to heal his daughter. And he said, look, I know what it's like to be in charge. I say come and go, and men do that, right? And so when he appealed to Jesus to heal, what was his implication in that? He knew Jesus was in charge, right? And that all he had to do was say it, and it would go. That's authority. That's the line of authority. So verse 15 comes along then, and it says, but she... or women, or woman, or whatever you want to pull that there, will be preserved through childbearing. Now you have the other bookends and brackets we have to put on it. Does that mean that it's required for women to have children in order to be saved? How do we know that? There are people who have taken this verse and have said that's what's required. How do we know that? That's not the case. I'll give you a hint. 1 Corinthians 7. Okay? 1 Corinthians 7 was a big treatise that Paul had on some of their relationships and things. And he said they were going through some difficult times, and that part of his message was, is it okay to get married? Yes. You can get married. There's no sin in that. Is it okay not to get married? Yes. That was okay too. Now, let's draw some real easy assertions here where he says if it's okay not to get married, and you're not supposed to have children outside of marriage, then there would be some who weren't married that wouldn't have children, right? And when he's going, oh, wow, we got a conundrum here because you have to have children. No, no. Obviously, it's not a requirement for salvation. So now the question becomes, what does he mean by that then? And there are a lot of different opinions on what he means by that. And one of the ones you will find a lot is going back to Genesis, where he talks about this promise going forward and how salvation would come through the lineage that was starting there and how women would be in childbearing. So that is one possibility. But I tell you what, after thinking about it for a long time this week and going over a lot of other things, I actually think it's simpler than that. The context we've stated, This small context, is roles and responsibilities, right? What is one of the roles that a woman has in mankind that men will never be able to do? Be a mother, right? Folks, I don't care how many transgender people we have who want to change things, they're not going to have children. Doesn't work that way, right? So when she says she's going to be saved through childbearing, and then there's a little teeny two-word piece after that. What does it say? She's going to be saved through childbearing if. Okay? So childbearing's not enough there. Obviously, what comes afterwards is the important part there when he says, if she does what? Maintains faith and love and sanctity or holiness, depending on your translation. And self-restraint. We're going to come back to that last one in just a second. So, I think what he's talking about there is the same thing about roles. Women need to accept the role that they're supposed to play, just like men are supposed to accept the role that they're supposed to play in God's kingdom. And by accepting those roles, we then come in line with what God wanted. I think that's a better way of looking at it. That is just an example of one role that men will never be able to fulfill. But look at this also. What happens here is that in the world today, people equate role with worth and with ability. That's not a proper equation. Role does not equal worth. Are men and women equal in the sight of God? We are told that multiple times. So people want to take that as a statement of worth and then translate it to the position of role. And this is what he's saying here is, sorry, goes, that doesn't translate. They're two different things. Have you ever had a boss that you really felt like you were smarter than? Most of us have been in that position. Does that make you the boss instead? No, they've got a different role. And we have to respect that role. So role does not equate to worth and ability. And that's where I think the world gets in trouble. Does that mean that women are anyway less than men intellectually? No. Although that's been preached in the past, right? And it's very important that we understand this in this context. And so when he starts looking at these things, this section on women begins and ends. It's a nice book in there where he says he wants them to behave modestly. But what's the last word that he put on that they'll be saved if? Self-restraint. Right? So we've got the modesty on one end and the self-restraint on the other end, that all of this fits in between. And I think it makes sense to me anyway, that it's fitting in the roles that God has.
And I think that's why he goes all the way back to Adam and Eve as well. I mean, that both of their issues were a failure to fulfill their role. He didn't lead the way he should lead. She didn't follow the way that she should follow.
Absolutely.
Both are equally problematic.
And the reason that he's putting this in this letter to Timothy, we don't see the Ephesus church. We only see the things that he's saying about them, right? But obviously, there was a problem there. There were women who weren't keeping to their roles. There were women who were trying to teach and exercise authority in places where they shouldn't have. There were men who weren't keeping their role. There were men who were arguing, fussing, and fighting, like guys are prone to do, when they shouldn't have. And so he's coming down on both sides here and saying people need to fulfill their roles and do what God wants them to. It's any possible number of combinations that come up. But whatever the situation is saying, we've got to play within our roles. Never underestimate the hand that rocks the cradle, right? That's a common expression in our world, and it's absolutely true. The mother's influence over the raising of children is absolutely not to be either minimized or discounted in any way. Okay. He then starts with, it's a trustworthy statement. And he's still kind of in this same context. We haven't gotten down to verse 13 yet. He says, if any man aspires to the office of an overseer, it's a fine work he desires to do. They needed overseers there. They needed strong leadership to help deal with these problems. These are the same people that he called to him in Acts when he was on his way to Jerusalem, when he was talking to the elders from Ephesus, and he said, you guys are going to have a tough job. There are going to be people that are coming up, even from within yourselves, that are going to try to destroy your flock. Well, here's Timothy now in sort of, I think, almost the fulfillment of what Paul was talking about those few years earlier when he was saying, you guys are going to have to be careful with this. And so the next group of people he wants to talk to are the elders and deacons, those who should have been the leaders and doing this. And so he puts these qualifications. Now, these are not in the order that they're in the verse. I shuffled them around, because I thought it was kind of interesting to do a side-by-side comparison. We've studied these a lot, but I think I want to look at it in the context just for a few minutes this morning of the view of the outside world of these people. Not only the view of inside the church and how their role and function should be, But when it says how they should conduct themselves in the household of God, that as Christians, here's how they ought to be as well, these leaders. What's one of the first line there is the same on both of them. What does it say? Husband of one wife, right? Now, that's buried down on, it starts with the one of them, and it's in the other place with the other one. And I don't think Paul was trying to make an in-order checklist here. He was giving the attributes and things. So I'm feeling free to shuffle them in this particular way. Why would that be one of the things listed? It's the Roman world. Anybody ever done any looking at what people's lives were like during that time period? Oh, yeah. The sensuality, the wreckage that they had made of marriage and of everything else was phenomenal. You think it's bad in this country or in other places of the world? Well, you're not yet to where Rome was. Not even close. And in the context of that, he says, husbands of one wife. You think that might have been difficult to find people in some roles that were like that? Probably was. Now, someone whose life was kind of messed up in that regard, could they get it straightened out and still be responsible before God? Sure. But they might be excluded from this role as an elder because that was one of the first things he listed. Manages his own household well. He gives a reason. I didn't put it up there. Why does he say that's something that they really have to be able to do? Exactly. If they can't manage their own household, then how are you going to manage a group of people that comprise a local congregation? It's not going to work well. And unfortunately, over time, I've seen instances of that, you know, where men who were appointed elders really didn't have control of their own household. Yeah. You're going to put me on the spot here, right? No, that is a very common question, and it is one that you wrestle with. Because the question is, he was the husband of one wife, right? My own personal feeling, and I will just put that on that level, is that none of these qualifications deal with past tense. So, for example, let's say when I was appointed an elder, everyone would look at it and say, he certainly fits that role of free from the love of money. But now I start being influenced by what I can get in terms of worldly gain. Well, when I was appointed an elder, past tense, I didn't have that problem. So am I still qualified? The other thing is reasoning. Question, why would it be necessary for an elder to be the husband or deacon to be the husband of one wife? What's the reasoning there? What's behind it? Yeah, and I think as you start looking at the role that an elder's wife plays, it winds up, even though, once again, the elder's the one that's responsible, there are active roles that an elder's wife plays. If you need to go talk to someone, having them along, especially if who you need to talk to is another female, is not only a good idea, it ought to be the law, but that's... Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that I can't be a complete man without a wife, but I don't think that I can be complete in the same sense. She fills something in me that provides differences in my ability even to deal with situations.
Yeah, absolutely.
And all of that. And I think that God is saying, if you're going to be in that position of leadership, I think he's looking for the completeness across the board to associate with that.
Yeah, and I think that also goes back when, and he might even bring the same Adam and Eve argument online, right? When Adam was there without Eve, there was something missing. And he said, I'll make a helper suitable. So what role does the wife play? The wife plays a helper that's suitable for her husband. Believe me, an elder needs that. Needs that badly. I personally, if, God forbid, Debbie were to pass away, I wouldn't keep it. No way. I wouldn't. So I fully respect someone who says that. Now, I've known others who said, well, that doesn't disqualify me. I'm still the same person and that kind of thing. I'm not sure that I would argue strongly with them about that and try to say, no, you're wrong. But I would say for me, if it were in my position, I would act that way as well. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Elders, quite frankly, it's at the will of the congregation is the service there. And so if the congregation didn't support that, the elder really would be in bad position to say, well, no matter what, I'm going to keep it. I don't think that's the way it works either. Okay, any other questions on that? Managing the own household. We only have a few minutes left. I was hoping to finish all of these, but we'll do what we can. He's got not addicted to wine, free from the love of money. And as you can see, there's kind of parallels as you go down there. I think the above reproach and respectable kind of matches over to being men of dignity, you know, when he's talking about how the rest of the world would look at them. And then he's got this not pugnacious, maybe not double-tongued, is pretty close to that. He's not really trying to set out them as separate things, but as ideas to, or these things are what tell you the character of that person, are they not? But then he's got a lot more of them that fall down where he says, holding to the mystery of the faith with the clear conscience is similar to able to teach and so on, but a little different. When you look at that list, you see over on the side, you've got temperate and prudent and gentle, peaceable, hospitable, good reputation outside the church that are not on the side of the deacons. I think some of those you can kind of go, well, it would make sense over there anyway. I mean, good reputation outside the church. If somebody had a really bad reputation, you certainly wouldn't want to just go, well, that's fine. We'll have them as a deacon anyway. But I was seeing something, and maybe it's just my brain and the way it works, in terms of the difference between these lists. Well, there's that one that it's looked at, but it once as addicted to much and one's addicted, right? Okay. I'm not sure the difference between the much in there at all. I don't think there's any difference in that one, but yeah. Yeah, I've heard that before, but I'm not sure they're inclusive because he's actually making arguments for two separate positions. Okay, that's what I got out of it. Maybe because it's I'm getting older and mellowing out a little bit, but I see some experience and age difference in that set of qualifications. Am I just blind, or does that make sense to anybody? Okay, yeah, and that's what I would look at. Instead of being one system or the other, I'd look at it as we're starting at this spot, and then if you want to move forward, there's some other things you got to add. Absolutely. Yeah, and so let's talk about that for a second because I think that's the second area that I see a big difference. One is I see tempering and age on one side, but the other is leadership and position of dealing with spiritual problems. Because when he starts saying things like temperate, prudent, gentle, peaceable, where do those characteristics come from? They are developed over time. Some of them are personality, but a lot of them are developed over time in learning how to deal and work with people, are they not? You start learning things like gentleness and peaceableness and things with your children, right? So I think that goes back to the managing household bit too, because unless you've learned those things with their children, how are you going to apply them when you get to really big children that you can't just send to bed? Right? Because a lot of times when it comes down to fusses and fights and difficulties that you face, when it's with adults, they act like children. And as part of learning to be an elder, you have to learn how to deal with those. So I see that as one of the differences there. So we have two different roles. What does deacon mean? It's a servant, right? And it has the implication in several places that it's used of being more of a physical kind of servant, right? One who is doing specific tasks. But the elder is given a very different role there. What's their primary responsibility? Spiritual leadership and spiritual health and well-being of the congregation where they are. Paul makes that real clear when he summons those elders from Ephesus and tells them, here's what you guys' responsibility is, right? And so I think as he's talking to Timothy here, we have to ask ourselves again real quickly, why is he going over these things with Timothy? And I think it's because they were having problems in this role. Perhaps there were men who wanted to be elders who did not fit these qualifications. Men who wanted to be deacons who did not fit these qualifications. And he's simply reminding Timothy, keep this in mind when you're there. And he's going to tell Titus the same thing in another book, a similar kind of situation, dealing with problems. Here's what you got to keep in mind and remember. There are roles. He's talked about men's roles. He's talked about women's roles. He's talked about elders' roles. He's talked about deacons' roles and how they are and how they live. And so when he finishes up here and he says, I write so that you may know how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God. You can substitute there as a Christian, which is the church of the living God. But what is the church of the living God? It is the pillar and support of the truth. What's the responsibility at a real base level, that's almost a pun, of the church? The responsibility is to be a pillar. What's a pillar? It's a support. It's a column that things sit on top of. And good pillars are big and stable, right? The pillar and support, or pillar and foundation, there's several different ways that that word is translated, but it's effectively the hard base. In other words, it's the firm ground on which the pillar sets to support what's on top, which is the truth. What is, does he mean there by the truth? We might have to finish that one next week. So here's your quiz for next week. Let's get a definition for the truth. It seems obvious in some ways, but I think we need to understand what Paul's wanting them to do. And then he comes out with this other, the last kind of, almost a hymn there, where he says, now those in the household of God, men, women, elders, and deacons should conduct themselves, and his summary there in that line, and we'll read it next week, is godliness. But let's talk about the truth. And we'll look at that summary, and we'll finish up chapter 3 next week. Thank you. Good questions. Appreciate the participation.